I'll try to be brief, Scott will be at length. And we have this paper which we wrote on compulsory licensing, which sort of joins our two sorts of expertise. I've spent a lot of time, as was mentioned earlier, trying to deal with the whole eminent domain problem of just compensation, public use, and when it gets put into place. And this is a kind of a subset of this particular issue, as it applies to patents often for drugs which are generally regarded as life-saving. And the question is how it is that one ought to think about these arrangements. And the rough division of labor that we're going to do here is I'm going to talk about generally some of the reasons for pharmaceutical patents and why the property rights model seems to be more attractive. And then Scott's going to go into all of the difficulties associated with the different measures of compulsory licensing. Because many of the arguments that are made here is, well, don't be upset about what's going on in Thailand. You guys do exactly the same thing when it comes to the United States. And I think the first situation is we're not going to defend the largest of these premises, but generally speaking, I think both of us have been on the sort of the property rights side of the property rights liability issue, thinking in effect that the valuation issues are absolutely critical in all of these cases and extremely difficult to do. But noting in effect with respect to many of these particular cases, it's not just the question of thinking of one isolated transaction where you have to worry about it, but trying to figure out how it is that you could deal with sequential transactions where the inputs from one particular case become the outputs, which become the inputs of the next transaction and so forth, and trying to figure out how you keep the entire supply chain moving into place on a series of situations where there could be unilateral expropriations and so forth, seemed to us to be an extremely dangerous kind of a situation because of the major instability associated with these property rights. The question then is, can you find exceptions to this rule presumptively? And we are certainly, I think, well aware of what you might want to call the mosaic problem, which is that, you know, you're Microsoft, you have this huge program out here, Ann Kelly had put together this morning, and it turns out there's one little piece in that thing which turns out to be an infringement. Do we take out the entire product and knock it dead? And our basic view on that question is, no, that's a little bit crazy. There's some discretion in equity. The appropriate way to handle that is to give them time to re-engineer the product, to remove the offending situation, at which point the negotiations become very serious on the other side, and give them interim damages, and then afterwards, 6 months or a year, whatever the appropriate time is, you start using the injunction so to handle the eBay problem in the temporal dimension rather than to handle it otherwise. More importantly, we don't think that there's much of a mosaic problem when you start to deal with the entire question associated with chemical patents and so forth. There are, of course, many cases in which what somebody gets a patent for is a sort of a range of chemicals as opposed to a single distinctive molecule. And I was actually on the other side, I might tell you, George, in the Celebrex Vioxx debate. With multiple variations, one of which was covering the Vioxx situation. And what happened is a specific one over the general, notwithstanding the temporal priority. That's the exception. Most of these patents do not have the standard problems associated with other kinds of patents, the boundary lines, the definitions, and so forth, single molecular entities of extreme power. And our attitude about them is essentially taken in two points. One is if you're the first to come in this situation, the amount of incremental gain that you do by opening up a new class of compounds is enormous, and allowing these guys to charge high prices sets out a huge magnet out there in which second-tier people with variations on the same thing will come in. And we think the way in which you handle this problem is not by trying to fiddle around with the liability rules, but by getting very accurate definitions on patent scope and so forth. And so Scott and I have this running disagreement amongst ourselves about Cox 2 patents and so forth as being kind of on the borderline. But the basic principle is we think use that lever rather than the other level, to steal a term from my friend Mr. Lemley over there, is probably the better way in which one wants to undertake this situation. So what we do is we start to envision fairly strong markets in these things with tradable commodities in which the major difference between patents on the one hand or patented technologies and other things is all concentrated in the scope and term limits rather than concentrated in the kinds of variations. And what we think about generally with respect to patents when you start to figure out how they become in compulsory licenses is that what's wrong with a compulsory license generically, there's several key problems with respect to it. Well, one of them is the moment you start making these licenses is somehow mandated upon somebody. The ability to create a system of exclusive licenses is going to be effectively compromised, and for a lot of important problems associated with commercialization, that turns out to be a mistake. And in addition to this particular problem, you have the second problem, is that if you look at the standard voluntary licensing agreement, it's always dense in terms with respect to collateral obligations. The typical licensing agreement essentially has a price term, which is itself not a term, but an elaborate set of schedules and so forth. And then in addition to that, there are probably 1,000 other terms having to do with milestones, licensings, cross-licensings, one thing or another. And what happens is you cannot have that type of arrangement survive if, in fact, somebody can simply snatch the device, use it on a naked price license, so that all of the other sort of synergies that are going to be created are, in fact, there. So this is a fact that the sort of the general argument, and now what Scott's going to do is sort of take it the one step forward and find out why it is that when you start looking at the Thai and similar experiences, what you see is, in fact, all sorts of peculiar arguments distinctive to that market, which I think are made more credible by virtue of the fact that the background presumption is the way in which we set it.
Thank you very much. Thank you for inviting me. And just to follow up.
After you, Alphonse. Costello.
So, and in keeping with our Abbott and Costello routine, I'll hit the ball back into your court on the Cox 2 policy lever point by just saying, and I think the source of our disagreement is not whether there could be a lever, but what the lever would be. My response would be, if what you're really worried about is assembly problems and boundary problems, in the Cox 2 case, I don't think it's assembly, I think it's boundary, mm-hmm. and the solution to boundary is notice, and so I would say, okay that the Cox 2 patent went down if you think that it lacked an adequate disclosure to give notice, but not okay if you think it could never have had, as a matter of fact, an mm-hmm. adequate disclosure to give notice. Mm-hmm. And then we could dispute with each other about mm-hmm. what would be an adequate disclosure mm-hmm. to give notice. And my bias there is that I wrote it, so I obviously thought it gave notice. But, you know, silly me, right? And, of course, I don't get to decide it.
We had a bet on this one before it came down.
We did, and I lost. I mean, the only thing I'll say on that one, if for those of you who want the inside baseball, is, you know, this is one of these examples where strategy really matters. The lawyers for that patent never argued that point, precisely because the litigation team was very different than the team who developed the strategy, and they made the mistake of divorcing themselves from their strategy team, and that's a reason to go to court with the people who develop your strategy rather than with developing your own strategy. But I think that the kind of bigger, to rise above the weeds on this, the bigger point is to then follow up by saying, okay, so what did Thailand do? And it's just worth noticing that Thailand, the government, in deciding to use compulsory licensing for pharmaceutical patents, published its reasoning. So its reasons were not simple, but an important reason reported by them for their own decision was, quote, Thailand is not the first country to apply compulsory licensing. Developed countries, including the USA, have done so. And then there's a citation to several examples. So a big chunk of this paper is, let's look at those examples that Thailand says are compulsory licensing in the United States, and let's see whether they're compulsory licensing, and let's see whether they're kind of the same as the Thai compulsory licensing. So there's a long catalog, but I think the chief examples boil down to four. They are copyright broadcast licensing, post-eBay denials of injunctions, government immunity in takings cases, and antitrust settlements and judgments. So let's just take these one at a time, because our view in this paper is that we think there are some really big differences between those and Thai compulsory licensing, and we think that those differences are not questions of degree, they're qualitative differences, and the differences actually really matter. They matter to kind of the route that you have to take in order to get to that outcome, and the outcome. So first the broadcast licensing, compulsory licenses, and the copyright setting. These really are the mosaic problem or the assembly problem. These are the transaction cost saving devices. And as Richard pointed out, that's not a pharmaceutical. I mean, a pharmaceutical is a 1-to-1, 1-to-2, 1-to-3 ratio of compound to patent. These are, you know, highly, highly complicated webs of IP rights. Number two, one of the criticisms of the copyright compulsory licensing in the broadcast space is that they're a public choice nightmare precisely because they flow out of highly evolved, negotiated transactions in Congress, which is to say they're voluntary. They're exactly not compulsory. I mean, they're representatives of producers and representatives of consumers put into a room to negotiate a rate, and then Congress codifies that rate. But that is far more voluntary than the executive branch agency just choosing to impose it by fiat after the fact. It's ex ante, and it's with participation.
And also remember, the government's on one side of the transactions with the CL, and they're not on either side with respect to the other transactions.
Exactly. And in fact, the Thai government expressly reports in their report that they didn't even approach the drug companies to try to negotiate, and then they give a justification for that. So it's a, you know, very, very, very different setting. And then the last point we make in the paper on this is that it's also interesting to ask, first as a theoretical and then as a factual question, why you don't see private ordering solutions for these transaction cost saving devices that you see in the copyright space. And at least we suggest in the paper, and I've written about in other settings, that the use of the mandatory rules that the copyright system imposes through this compulsory licensing, if it were done in the patent space, I think would have the effect of foreclosing some of the private ordering that you see. So the private ordering that you see in the patent space are the reagent freezer programs. So basic biological scientists want to use patented restriction enzymes and other reagents. You would think that there could be an anti-commons problem or a failure to conduct biological science, and you'd have to have, for every biologist, a lawyer ready to negotiate a patent license. And yet the reagent manufacturers are allowed to, and indeed have elected to, provide very low transaction cost models for basic scientists to get access to these reagents, which are, you know, when you want to go buy a can of Coke, right, the Coca-Cola company has provided a low transaction cost way to buy a can of Coke. You put a dollar in the Coke machine, they make change. In the reagent freezer program, if you're a basic scientist and you want a restriction enzyme that's patented, you just go to the freezer, it's like going to the Coke machine, and you take a free can of Coke, free to you, zero transaction cost. Now your lab pays up front a fee, and the reagent freezer program owner goes around to each lab at the end of each week or each month, depending on the reagent, counts the number of tubes missing, and bills the laboratory supervisor. But that, for the scientist, is a ridiculously low transaction cost event. Now, that model is out if you impose compulsory licensing. That model is in if you allow private ordering. So that's the copyright example. Totally different than Thai compulsory licensing. The next example Thailand uses is the post-eBay denials of injunction. And I think that there are basically 2 points to make here, although the paper makes them in more depth. I'll try to just be quick because I think you'll get them quickly. One is if you have a mosaic problem, and the Z4 case is a good example where the courts post-eBay say, look, if you really have a very tiny piece of a really, really big technology, we won't stop the technology. Yeah, but by the way, Microsoft did pay $115 million in damages. That's not trivial, and that's a lot more than the Thai compulsory licenses. So it's a very limited set, and there's still a fairly high price. Number two, the second setting is the setting in which there really is no ability to get access because, for example, you have patent suppression going on. But that's exactly the opposite of what's going on in the drug setting. The drug companies want to sell to Thailand. They want to provide. And the example you see post-eBay is Finisair. But in the Finisair case, you've got a denial of an injunction where the patentee was not practicing and was not licensing. So short of those very modest situations post-eBay, we generally do see practicing entities get injunctions. And drug companies are practicing entities. In fact, they're the epitome of practicing entities. So again, you see this as very, very different, in part because you're getting the injunctions, and in part because when the damages awards are imposed, they're at prices that are far above marginal cost. And the key, the explicit key to the Thai compulsory license is marginal cost pricing. So in these reasonable royalty cases where you've got an ongoing act of infringement, post-eBay, you're seeing damage awards that maybe are too high, but I don't think you are saying they should be so low as to be marginal cost. I think you are saying that maybe they should be lower than they are, but the Thai compulsory licensing example is all the way down to marginal cost, so qualitatively different. That same kind of pricing difference applies in the taking setting, right? So if you've got a government taking, you're going to fully compensate for both fixed cost plus marginal cost. You're not going to just compensate for marginal cost. And then lastly, the antitrust setting. This is, we think, the cart before the horse. I mean, in an antitrust setting where the final remedy is some kind of coerced license, it's worth noticing, number one, it's only after a very, very drawn-out process. The Thai government's process was the stroke of a pen. That's not a kind of full adjudicative process. It's not even anything close. And indeed, you only see these antitrust remedies in cases where you've got the precursor of, market power.
It's not just monopoly, it's monopolization.
Absolute. I mean, it's a big thing, not just a sliding scale of stuff. And that's not at all what you see in the drug cases. So I'll just wrap up by saying that the risks we see of compulsory licensing are that you end up compulsory licensing like in the Thai model, where it's forced, it's after the fact, and it's at marginal cost. You see a number of problems. You see a problem where you get either tit-for-tat games starting to be played, because basically what that's saying is somebody wants a free lunch for the rest of the world to pay for the drug. And the problem with that is that it's not clear to see why you won't start getting racing games where everybody wants the free lunch and nobody wants to pay. You then run the risk of getting side deals where, okay, we'll give you permission to do compulsory licensing and we'll have your back, we'll pay for the fixed cost of the drug, but by the way, then we want you to do something else for us. And our paper's response to that is, we're not fundamentally against wealth transfer. We want it to be above the table. So if what you're saying is, there are poor people in the world and they need access, there are a lot of ways to achieve that, including having the governments of those countries buy the drugs. If they don't have enough wealth, find a way to get them the wealth, but do all of that above board, because one of the things that does is it's sometimes it's kind of nice to have given and to be recognized for having given. Giving without recognizing that you've given is very different than giving and getting a thank you, especially from the world community.
I've just a couple of little comments. One of the things I think that also has to be mentioned here is that if you ever want to think of somebody for whom compulsory licensing is dubious, sovereign nations, I think, may well be that. And there are two reasons. One is that we know from Pat Danzen and a bunch of other research that price discrimination based upon ability to pay is certainly very much a part of this particular process, and that you don't see constant prices across the world. And drug companies, as George can tell you, the arbitrage issue is absolutely a major issue in these particular cases. Volume discounts complicate the matter further. Distribution chains for many of these drugs is an extremely important question. And so a lot of times what happens is if you're going to lower the price of the drug as it goes into the country, you may tie it into an extremely vulnerable and dangerous distribution system, or one which is highly monopolized at the local level, so none of this stuff gets down to the individual consumers, but essentially creates our rates for these particular producers in terms of what is going on. And if you also, if you have all of these particular powers, then to say on top of it, you want to use compulsory licensing, it's not that you're going to be at marginal cost. I mean, my sense is that the threat is much more dangerous in some sense for the following reason, which is if you do not issue a compulsory license, the usual quid pro quo is that we will now take it upon ourselves to make the stuff domestically, and we will not restrict ourselves with respect to the question of whether there's only going to be domestic sales. So that there's the kind of implicit threat that's going on here is we'll have a leaky bucket and some of this stuff will make it out. I think that, is that in fact what you do fear, George, or am I basically making you more hysterical than you are?
Well, they think so. So one follow-up, and I think Richard touched on this, and this will shock some of you to hear, at least me and maybe Richard, I think, to embrace regulatory approaches. But let's recognize that, if you're China, for example, or Brazil or Thailand, you've got a big health and safety regulatory problem, which is distribution of drugs in your country. And those are very expensive practices. Now, if you allow commercial enterprises to engage in them at commercial rates, you've got somebody you can regulate. If the black market's doing it, or the free market, free as in zero price, then there's no one you, the regulatory agency, can regulate. At least regulate effectively. So safety and efficacy of the drugs becomes really a problem in the distribution channel.
That sounds like it's moving a little bit too much, because then it's their interest that there will be, unlimited, unrestricted patent duration, for example. Because you give a patent not for 20 years, but 200 years, that means that the patent owners will, to their benefit, distribute it without, health and hazards, right? I don't think you're saying that. So,
no, but I'm also not quite following that.
No, what he's trying to say is that if you just have a single monopoly patent and it has this advantage, fine. But what
Binet... Also in the patent paper but that there is
the distribution... The ants, no.
Private enterprise to distribute it, and that would be to the benefit of the time.
No, Omri, there is the following situation. You don't need, in order to get efficient distribution, you don't necessarily need to have the original patented entity to do this. But what happens is there's often a very complicated sharing of distribution networks between generic suppliers in a given place and patented ones, and one or another will use the mechanism which is supplied, so that one company will take on the distribution with respect to both. You're going to find that's harder to do if it turns out that you create the compulsory licenses, because amongst other things, if a generic has a cooperative arrangement worldwide with a manufactured company, it's going to be very reluctant to take on the contraband goods in what will likely to be violation with respect to its situation. So we are assuming that the normal rules with respect to this moving into that generic market are there. And ironically, in most of these other countries, the generic market is a mess, because the low price that you could get for production coupled with the high demand, which you have just as if it were patented, creates this situation where the intermediates are the ones who manage to extract the monopoly rent. So you go to, for example, to Italy or France, and you see all these little green pharmacy signs out there. You know what those all stand for? They all stand for local monopoly, no national distributor allowed, is what those things mean.
And so what happens is that you're not going to, a lot of times this stuff just doesn't get down to the folks at the bottom. Now, I don't think that's actually the case with the AIDS drugs with respect to Thailand. And essentially the industry's position, as I understand it, is we don't like the Thai situation. We're not going to be able to roll it back, but we just don't want it to be extended, either to other countries or to other products or to other situations. Okay, Randy and then Jonathan.
I guess I want to understand a couple of things. So it seems to me that the logic is that if they could solve the arbitrage problem, then we'd have a straightforward licensing problem, where the question is whether they're going to be able to exercise monopoly power in that market or not, and where the threat of compulsory license mitigates the exercise of that monopoly power.
Well, right now, they have the power
is that,
to...
Is that the right... Way to think about
no, it's
that.
Not quite right, because what that does is it excludes the other thing, which is always available to them, is a monopoly. They're already monopsony buyers.
Well,
you have the threat in effect.
But that's not to say that puts you in a bilateral monopoly situation.
Yeah, and this puts
right?
you in a confiscatory situation. And there's nothing that anybody can do under any situation.
Why would you in favor of the exercise of monopoly power?
By whom?
By the pharma company.
What? I mean, they monopoly power because of the new entrant that comes in by virtue of the fact
because,
that they're...
Because they're the sole source of this drug.
Well, of this one, but the fact that the more you have the monopoly power at the front end...
Take the pure case.
The pure case is even there, the reason why you favor it is because the stronger you make it, the more likely the second guy's going to come in order to erode. And the first guy will come...
Yeah,
well, but not in Thailand.
Exactly, not in Thailand. You've got to assume that these drugs are... These guys say we're not pivotal to the existence of these drugs. If we don't bear any of the fixed costs associated with these drugs, they will still continue to exist.
Well,
yes?
Time out. I mean, if you really... I mean, I do think there are reasons to be cautious about the Gates Foundation, State Department, wealth transfer to Roche or Merck problem. Okay, which I guess you're worried about too, right? Which is,
well, I'm worried about the exercise of monopoly power, and then we can go to that issue separately.
I mean, I think they flow inextricably one to the other because, as a practical matter, some of that will happen, and I'm sensitive to it. But at the same time, I do think. As a practical matter, that if you feel kind of as strongly as you do.
No, I don't feel anything.
Oh.
Yeah. No. I mean, your argument, in effect, Randy, also gets you to the point, not only marginal cost pricing, virtually zero cost pricing, because the quantities demanded is sufficiently low, that if they just make the stuff at their own expense.
That's what your argument is, right?
So here's our argument, right? So no. So our argument...
I don't understand that.
No, we didn't...
No. The argument is that you that before rushing to at the stroke of a pen declare marginal cross pricing for your politically favorite business partner in your domestic region, you might want to at least consider that pricing above marginal cost is your own social duty to the world community to some extent, because these things have a fixed cost, and you might at least consider...
Is that an efficiency argument? I'm not quite sure what that is, because we seem to agree that these drugs are going to exist with or without...
No. We don't agree with that.
Yeah, we don't. And
your
paper
does.
No, we don't. No, we agree that they'll exist.
Whether or not Thailand...
Exactly.
Right.
Brazil?
I agree.
No, you do it with Brazil, you don't get the same argument.
Sounds like I'm with you. Thailand should do what it's doing.
No,
but
no,
I think
no.
As a practical matter, you're going to start to see, and I think you already are starting to see...
Brazil and India?
Yeah, and fairly aggressive tit-for-tat games being played in the WTO, where we the United States government now basically says to pharma and Hollywood and Madison Avenue, or the fashion industry, look, you know, we'll play you off against each other to see who on trade wars we'll fight with overseas. But that's that's a combination of big, as an efficiency matter, I do think that's a set of big problems domestically and with international
trade. But I assume on that, and I don't know the history at all, that we, the United States, have been disproportionately bearing the fixed cost of these drugs.
Yeah, we are.
And that there hasn't been this tit-for-tat trade war going on, notwithstanding that. Right? So if Canada underprices, and if Canada, because it's a monopoly buyer, is effectively not carrying its share of the fixed cost, we haven't said, okay, Canada.
No, we understand that. I mean, but that's the point of the argument, which is that if, in fact, you allow these nations, which I don't particularly approve of, to, as sovereigns, exercise monopsony power, the question is, what's the social improvement by taking the next step and going to compulsory licensing? And it's a big difference because the compulsory licensing stuff, in many ways, also has the threat of, we produce the dub, and then we're going to sort of undermine your other markets. Now, they haven't done that yet in Thailand, but there's nothing which says that if you allow the threat in the short run, they cannot amplify it, either through indirection because of under-enforcement or through conscious social policy. Plus, and that you would, I assume, the arbitrage issue, I assume.
Well, that's why I started where I did, right? So it's really a question of who should bear the arbitrage risk. And the drug company is obviously going to say, we shouldn't bear it, you guys should bear that, and that's why we can't have you with
these underlying drugs. No, look, I mean, everybody understands in terms of this particular market that the actual losses in terms of foregone revenue relative to the total revenue stream are, in fact, quite small. And nobody wants to deny that. I think that the key issue that people are worried about is that imitation is a serious form of danger, and that if you start to move from Thailand into more populated companies and do exactly the same arguments, at that particular point you risk massive forms of destabilization, which you don't risk in quite the same proportions with respect to the monopsony buyer. And, you know, under those circumstances, essentially, you'll still price the same way in the United States, even if it turns out that you can get more money overseas. Why would you abandon your maximization strategy? But the key point is that if you know that there's a larger revenue stream in the future, small marginal effects will make small differences, but the pool of drugs 20 years down the road, if in fact you have a sort of even compulsory, not even if you have monopsony buying as opposed to compulsory licensing prices, will be somewhat larger, and so there is a negative externality with respect to everybody else everywhere else.
And let's just make sure we let in Becky and John.
Okay, and then
isn't this the place to, you know, debate this in negotiating the terms of the TRIPS agreements and other multilateral agreements concerning intellectual property protection? And didn't we resolve in the course of that countries have this option?
No, we did not.
Yeah, so this is a violation. You're saying it's a violation of the TRIPS agreement. Then isn't that the end of the matter?
Well, again, the paper.
You know, aren't there? I'm sorry. Let me just interrupt you a little bit longer because I fear that this is never going to speak again.
A moral hazard, of course.
Well, no, but I mean, you know, countries might legitimately disagree about whether they would rather have access more cheaply to existing drugs or whether they would want to have more drugs in the future, depending on their means and depending on their health problems. And, you know, I mean, we've sort of, you know, had this rare moment to sort of override the preference of different sovereigns and say, no, we insist that you must have strong drug protection, drug patent protection. So we agreed, you know, they agreed to what they agreed, and they didn't agree to more. If this is a violation of that, I suppose, then it seems like what you can say is, look, you may regret the deal you struck, but this is the deal you struck, and you're violating.
I think the answer is the TRIPS agreement is sufficiently ambiguous that nobody knows the deal that you struck.
That's right.
Well, and
but it's ambiguous,
and we'll go a little,
because they weren't willing to agree what.
No. I mean, they would have blown the whole thing apart at the time, and so there was a diplomatic, deliberate ambiguity.
Yeah,
you can
although,
read
frankly,
that clause until you're blue in the face and you will not know what it
means. Yeah, I mean, at least I, for one, would be less generous about its ambiguity. I think it says emergency and there's no emergency here. But quite the opposite. This was all planned. But even assuming that's the issue, I do think it's worth noticing that the paper does not discuss TRIPS, is not designed to be a brief on TRIPS.
Well, we'll add something in there.
We may, but most importantly, the paper is designed to say a core argument was, look, you guys do it too. And the paper is designed to say, no,
that's
we don't,
wrong.
And here's why. And if that's all the paper achieves, we're actually happy with that. We're not trying to win a Nobel Prize or solve the drug pricing problem for the United States or the world.
This is...
But we are trying to point out that a a credible argument was made.
And it's wrong.
And it's wrong. And it's wrong. It's wrong as a matter of fact. And it's wrong because there are some important reasons why the facts are different.
AJ?
And that's not a trivial contribution, we hope.
AJ, let's try to take some more questions.
Yeah, there's another type of compulsory license in the patent area invention. It might get expanded after reform legislation. That's the rule on prior user rights with like business methods.
Yeah. So there are other examples. The paper is not designed to be an exhaustive list of all the ways in which there's so-called under-enforcement or what other people would call optimal enforcement. But the paper is designed to address a core argument, the four core examples, and in 7,500 words, you got to make choices.
Yeah, but anyhow, Chris, did you have a question?
Yeah,
and then Jonathan.
A lot of this strikes me as deeply empirical in the following sense. So one of the reasons I think that monopsony purchasing in Canada doesn't hurt the incentive to invest in drug development as much as it does is because the U.S. is being soaked, right? So assume for a moment that the U.S. is soaked less, then suddenly monopsony pricing in Canada and other places emerges as a big problem. So this is all adjustable.
No, I don't think that's right.
We are propping up the prices, the manufacture of drugs by
we're bearing
prices
fixed
the
costs.
Right.
We're bearing
a huge share of the fixed costs. So that's
But if we got more from Canada, we would not lower our prices here necessarily. We would probably take most of it out in the form of new drugs.
Well,
Randy nodded when I said that before.
If a decision had been made on Medicare,
I'm saying that.
Right, then we'd have a very different picture of how much Canadian monopsony hurts.
What we do is the same position. The industry does this, but we mentioned that in the paper. The Medicaid pricing problem is extremely difficult because either you have a price cap or otherwise the subsidy all goes to the industry. And there's no conscionable way that you could say that if we wish to give this thing, we have to make it transferable to the producers rather than the consumers of goods. The difficulty is that's deeply empirical because we don't know how deeply these price cuts cut and whether or not what they do is they go below marginal costs or they give some kind of an unfair advantage. We just mentioned that problem in this paper. I don't think there's anybody in the industry who actually knows the way in which it works. People have deep resentments towards the main system, which seems to be more aggressive than anybody else,
right.
but no in principle objection that I can see or maintain with respect to the practice in general. Jonathan, and then Mark, and then we have to,
Back very quickly to your conversation with Randy.
Yeah.
I mean, is it not possible that there's an efficient bargaining structure between the government of Thailand and these drug manufacturers?
We say that in the paper.
Yeah, well, right, but I mean, I'm not sure this is exactly what he's proposed in the paper, sort of low-cost licensing that captures a large proportion of the Thai market in exchange for very, very heavy restrictions on reimportation and things like that.
We think that's possible.
Why do we think that?
We have a section on that.
The question is, it
was not a criticism of the question. It was just designed to say, great question. We think it's sufficiently important that we wrote a section about it.
So why do you think that hasn't arisen?
Because the political situation is that they're going crawling. It's like going crawling to Potter, if you remember the great image in It's a Wonderful Life. They basically decided unilaterally that any negotiation would be capitulation, and so they wanted to avoid it. This thing was done unilaterally on their point for domestic market consideration.
Any capitulation by the Thai government?
Yes. They thought coming to us is like crawling to Potter. Do you remember the famous line? What? Do any of you remember It's a Wonderful Life?
I remember the movie. I don't remember.
Oh, okay. You know,
well, just before we get into the movie.
It's a monopsony bank, right?
Richard, before we get into the movie, but just I do think there is one other, and we'll jump to Mark in a sec, but there's another point I just wanted to drop in to mop up on the distribution stuff. The Chinese Food and Drug State, what is it called, the SFDA, the State Food and Drug Administration, has been talking a lot about how really difficult it is to deal with their distribution systems. And in contrast with those in the Chinese government who have been in favor of compulsory licensing, they have been interested in seeing commercial distribution precisely because they find that they can have a more effective relationship regulating commercial distributors than they can regulating the cronies of those who got the compulsory license. Because then they're fighting the central party rather than fighting a commercial actor.
We think you'll get lower consumer prices with some degree of voluntary market. So that we don't think in the end it's the ultimate access issue is there. Mark, did you have a question? I can't believe that you didn't. You'll make one up if you did.
I did. So it seems to me that one possible sort of argument is the arbitrage argument, right?
Yeah.
Which I think is a very real risk, and both in the sense of manufacture the low-cost drug in Thailand and ship it into the United States, but also in the sense of what you might call kind of legal argument arbitrage, right? Which is the most favored nation pricing status, right? They did it, so we can do it too. And I guess what I'm trying to do is sort out whether you think that that's the real problem or whether you think that the answer is, even if we could solve that problem, that we really are getting some fundamental new fixed cost coverage from the incentive.
I don't think that we're making the argument, by the way, that you can eliminate the problem. So solving it is a strong term. We just think that there are different, that there are good reasons to suspect with confidence that it's much worse in some settings than in others. So for example, and this is a cute one, but you know, imagine paying your newspaper delivery person for every newspaper she picks up, but not for every newspaper she delivers. Why would you be surprised if she doesn't deliver? And if in fact there are wealthy people in another part of the world who will pay for the delivery, why wouldn't you be surprised if they get delivered there? And I think that's a big part of the so-called black market or international arbitrage problem, which is when you've got domestic commercial distribution channels, someone's making sure that that actual newspaper delivery person delivers the drug to the patient as opposed to dumping them in the dumpster or selling them on the black market.
Let me stop you there because I'm entirely with you on the severity of that problem and the justification of preventing arbitrage, what I'm trying to do is tease out whether that is the problem you are objecting to, or whether even were we able to solve the arbitrage problem, you still think that there's some need for the few rich people in Thailand to pay a lot of money.
Yeah, I mean, look, one of the things that we do believe is that there's no reason to tie subsidies for drugs to drug manufacturers. You certainly, for example, let's say the following situation. Suppose you can only play this game with respect to drugs that are patented, but not with respect to those that are generic. And that it turns out that if you actually do a first dollar best estimate, that the generic drug, you could get more of it at better potency than you could with this. If you're going to get the subsidy on the one and not on the other, it's an incentive for these guys to shift to the inefficient project rather than to the more efficient project. Because every time you change relative prices, this is a real problem. And we think that the actual integration between the generic market on the one hand and the patented market on the other, in terms of relative pricing and distribution systems, is an important and somewhat neglected element in this. And just to put it in perspective, when I was in South Africa just when the AIDS conference was there in 2000, and I don't know if you remember the really vitriolic stuff that took place then. And it turns out, if you actually looked at it, 98% of the drugs that they needed to treat AIDS in South Africa were already generic at the time. I mean, this was just all quite hysterical. And what they needed was not to sort of expropriate these drugs and all the political costs. They needed just a bunch of refrigerators. I mean, to make sure that the stuff didn't simply go off market.
But that is a non-trivial problem, right? Which is that this shift. So first of all, it's not actually in Thailand, I think, where a lot of the manufacturing takes place. It's in Brazil and India, where there already are fairly well-developed biotech plants, essentially fabs, number one. Number two, not only are those Thai and Indian, the Brazilian and Indian fabs producing this stuff rather than the Thai ones, they often then shift from producing other things, so there's a social cost here, right? You're shifting from producing some stuff to producing other stuff that they can then sell for a much higher value, because while they're dumping it in Thailand, they're also dumping it in Europe and the wealthy parts of North Asia.
Okay, Anyone else have a question? Or now, who actually knows where we're eating dinner tonight? And when?
There are maps on the table outside.
Okay, and what time is it?
Okay, let me make the announcement. We're eating at Bin 36. We start at 7 o'clock if you want to come for hors d'oeuvres and drinks and cocktails. At 7:30, they will seat us up in a special area. It's a very large restaurant, so find the corner where they will isolate us. And there is a bus to take you or a car to take you, but there is a very bad storm passing through. It might be delayed for a few more minutes. So
I'm going to be driving down at around 6:45 or something like that, and I'm happy to take anyone. Randy, are you coming tonight?
I'm not.
Are you coming on?
Yes. Could you take?
Is anybody? Jonathan, no, you don't live downtown. You live downtown.
Right, I can come.
Okay, so anyhow, no. If you're staying at the hotel, it's walking distance.
Right.
So okay, I'll pick you up at the same time, about 6:45.
Sure.
All right. Now, thank you all for a very wonderful session.